So, tell me about last night.
Well, it wasn't what I expected. It had the perfect amount of spice.
Sounds hot.
It had all the flavor, and I wanted more. The ghost pepper wings from Popeyes are just so delicious.
Wait, I thought you were talking about your date.
Sometimes, things aren't always as they seem. Like Popeyes ghost pepper wings that have the perfect level of kick and flavor. Try them for only $5 today. Limited time at participating U.S. restaurants. Price may vary. Tax extra.
Love that chicken from Popeyes.
So that was John Lennon expressing in 1974 his dissatisfaction with the record company's penchant for taking recordings that were intended to be mono releases and then trying to convert them to stereo rather clumsily, and how aesthetically there were certain decisions that the Beatles made, especially for the singles market, where the mixes needed to be mono to really get the guts across of what they were doing. Revolution being a great example of a song that was fully intended for mono, didn't quite work in the 19... or the, I don't know what year they mixed it in stereo, but the subsequent stereo mix.
You mean the mock stereo? Is that what they call the mock stereo mix?
Yeah, I mean, there was a term for it in America, but it was something that was rather inartfully done just in order to get a stereo mix out there. By the way, this is Robert Rodriguez.
And this is Richard Buskin.
And that's Richard. And we're talking something about the Beatles. We'd mentioned in a previous show we would discuss some of the mono stereo differences in some of the Beatle recordings. What you heard there was a sort of hybrid. It was the mono single version of Revolution with a stereo interlude starting the second verse spliced in, so you can kind of get the sense of where it all changes and how, indeed, as John Lennon said, it was a much more powerful record in mono.
Yeah, and you know, as we did mention in the previous show, I don't think people out there realize just how many differences there were between the mono and stereo mixes right from the beginning of the Beatles' recording career with EMI. I mean, it starts really with Please Please Me.
Yes.
On there, there's a vocal flub on John's part that's on the stereo version that's not in the mono version.
Do you know why there is that variance between the mono and the stereo?
No, I don't actually.
This is the story, as I recall it, was that, okay, to rush the mono single into market, they did that, and it took off. It did much better in the charts than Love Me Do had done, and that was what sort of forced their hands, like, well, I think we better get a stereo mix of this, because that was when they decided to plan the album, and they knew down the road they would need a stereo mix of that. So the two-track tape of the single take of Please Please Me, where the vocals and the pronouns were perfectly fine. Apparently that tape didn't exist anymore. They destroyed it once they'd mastered it as a single. So they had to go back to some of the outtakes they still had, and one of the ones they had that was still intact on the two-track was the flubbed pronoun at that last verse, and that was the one that they were able to, because they had the elements there, to make it into a stereo mix.
But it's interesting, because as you're saying, this is a very short time later, and
yes,
they'd already wiped the tape.
Yes.
Amazing.
Right. So here it is, folks, if you've never noticed the difference before.
Last night I said these words to my girl. Why, no, I never even tried, girl. Come on, come on, come on, come on.
I know that most effort went into the mono mixes. That's what they, you know, that's what the Beatles were interested in.
Mm-hmm.
That's what George Martin said all the effort went into. Often the stereo mixes were done once the Beatles even left the studio, and done like in half an hour.
Yeah, as an afterthought. Mono was the currency. You know, to give you sort of the Reader's Digest version of the philosophy at the time, you know, you had mono was AM radio, so it was very important for the singles to be in mono, and it was really what the majority of record buyers were purchasing, because stereo equipment cost more, and it was sort of pitched to the highbrow listeners who, you know, listen to classical or jazz. You know, it was not really something, a rock and roll medium at the time, you know, as the Beatles sort of spearheaded that transition by the mid-60s of making these much more elaborately produced recordings where, you know, to give the recording some space, some breathing room with the layers of, you know, elements added, you know, stereo sort of really came into its own as the way to get these things across in a way that mono really couldn't. Although, you know, there were the hardcore practitioners, you know, like the Phil Spectors, the Brian Wilsons, who stuck with mono as long as they possibly could as the preferred medium. But as Richard was saying, the Beatles and their engineers preferred to work with mono. It wasn't until later on that they even gave it much thought at all. So you had a lot of these early stereo mixes were sort of offhandedly thrown out there.
It's just interesting that, you know, these days a lot of people are listening to stereo, including on radio. You know, they're often broadcasting the stereo version. And so people are used to some of the different, you know, well,
yeah,
it's the only version they know, basically, and they don't realize that the mono could have been quite a bit different. You know, the follow-up single to Please Please Me, From Me to You, the stereo version doesn't have the harmonica intro, whereas on the mono, there is the harmonica that, you know, accompanies the vocals at the beginning. as far as I know, that wasn't part of the actual recording, that harmonica at the intro. So I think that was lifted from a section of the instrumental solo break.
Yeah, sort of flown in later. Yeah. And it's a curious thing to think about that, you know, if they're preparing these mixes in mono for the widest possible circulation, this is what the majority of people in the 60s are going to be hearing the first time they hear the brand new Beatles record, is the mono versions. And so when they would, you know, then dutifully make these stereo mixes to serve that aspect of the market, once they started having hits and selling millions of records, how they would make these choices that something would be different from the mono mix, as like, oh, here's a way we can improve this, as in the case of For Me to You. But there are many, many more of those. And, you know, we take many shows to cover every one of these.
I mean, you know, some of the sort of highlights, the more notable ones for me, for instance, If I Fell.
Oh, yes.
Where in the second go-around of the bridge section, Paul goes up high on the vocal and his voice cracks on the stereo version,
yes,
not on the mono version.
Right.
Would be sad if our new love was in vain. Was in vain. So
and I've read conflicting, you know, reports about that. One saying that that was just a sort of mess up in the mix on the stereo version, where it just sort of phased out a bit of his vocal, makes it sound like it's cracking.
Right.
I've read elsewhere that actually, no, his voice did crack, and so they just flew in his vocal from the first bridge and corrected it. What have you heard about that?
Pretty much the same thing you're saying there. I mean, the thing to me that, if you try to think it through critically, it's like, why would his high harmony be on a separate track from the rest of the vocals, that there would be a mixing error that suddenly it drops out? Wouldn't all the vocals have been recorded in 64 on the same track?
Amazing to me. We know how sort of egotistical these guys are, and in Paul's case, what a perfectionist.
Right.
And so you'd have thought that you might have heard the stereo and go, hey, hold on, you're making me sound like I can't sing here, you know.
And I'm thinking that, you know, part of it is the pressure of getting these recordings done and out to the market, that they don't have the luxury, at least at that time, to get everything just so. I mean, if you want a nitpick, you can listen to some of the double tracking issues that occurred in some of the earlier recordings, where the vocals might not be entirely in precise sync.
Absolutely. I mean, there are vocal flubs. As I said, there's that one on Please Please Me. There's one on Drive My Car. I did ask George Martin about that. I said, how did these kind of get through? And he said to me, you know, what we were going for was the feel.
Yes.
And he said, whereas these days everything has to be corrected and made perfect, he said the feel was right. I didn't want to get them back in to redo it. So I leave it as it is.
Yeah, and it's funny that that philosophy has kind of fallen by the wayside, because in the digital age where they're putting out Beatles 1 and they're going back, and little things that can be digitally fixed, like the dropout and Day Tripper, they're going ahead and fixing. And they're going for this kind of precision that, you know, the Beatles sold millions of records with the flaws intact. I don't think any fan would object to preserving those. And it kind of irritates me that, you know, as a listener for years and years, you're wanting that experience and the best possible sound. So it's fine if they want to fix the overall sound, but you don't need to fix the glitches.
Right.
That said, the first time I heard the remasters in 2009 when they came out with those, there was such clarity. I was very conscious of hearing where the seams were in the recordings, where they were taking multiple takes and splicing them together for the perfect one. And I hadn't really noticed that so much in the vinyl or in the earlier CD iterations. All of a sudden now in the remastering, especially I'm going back to like the With the Beatles album, you could hear, at least I could, I was a lot more conscious of the splicing than I had been before.
Yeah, and what kind of intrigues me a bit is, okay, on some of the stereo mixes, you hear certain things as well that weren't so evident in the mono. So you may hear someone coughing and, you know, certain things will come through. But what I find intriguing is that a song like Help, the mono mix and the stereo have actually totally different vocals, not sounding different. They are different vocals.
Yes.
On the stereo, John's vocal has got a much sort of rougher sound to it.
Yes. It's raspier, the vocal. The difference in that recording, that single mono mix, was the tambourine.
Yeah, absolutely. And so that's on the stereo as well, isn't it, the tambourine?
I think one has it and one doesn't.
Yeah, I think it's the stereo.
Well, let's listen to it and see.
Yeah.
Help, I need somebody. Help, not just anybody. Help.
You know I need someone. Done before. Help me if you can, I'm feeling down, and I do appreciate you being round. Help me get my feet back on the ground. Won't you please, please help me, help me, help me.
Unlike Richard, I was like a Latter-day fan who didn't experience the Beatles when they were happening, so I was raised on the stereo mixes that Apple put out in the 70s, and the very first Beatle album.
A mere child, a Beatle child.
Yes, yeah, yeah. I was sort of this like second-tier Beatle fan, but... Yeah.
One of the original muckers, as we would say in England.
No. So the Red Album was my first album, and so I was used to the stereo mixes very early on, and it was only later, once you know my level of fandom had risen, that I went back to investigate the mono. So my ears were attuned to the stereo, and that was the mono that sounded strange to me. And it's the opposite for people that actually experienced the Beatles in the 60s.
Were you also used to, like 10 years after, if you like, in this case, were you used to the reverb-laden American mixes of those early albums as well?
Yeah, because that was, you know, and buying the catalog.
In the 70s, that's still what was available.
It was still what was available, yes. Yeah. On the Apple label, they put out Beatles' second album and Beatles 65 and all that stuff. And so I scooped up all that stuff as I was getting into them. And so that was like the norm, the standard for me. Didn't question it till I started, you know, getting adventurous, and, you know, there'd be Gem Records stickers on these, you know, with the Beatles for sale. And so I started acquiring those.
He was raised on the phony.
Yeah. Well, but so were millions of other people, and hence the capital boxes we have. Mm-hmm. But I will say that maybe unlike a lot of people, you know, that I've anecdotally talked to about, you know, the most egregious example being the I Feel Fine, She's a Woman single, I do prefer the original British mixes and not that Dave Dexter, you know, slathering on the echo with a trowel version.
Those are the mixes the Beatles were involved
in. And that's how it should be. You know, if you have any respect for their art, although, you know, we can get into a discussion of some of the stuff they put out in mono that I thought was superior in stereo, whether they intended it or not, but that's a different discussion.
Yeah. But then, you know, we start moving forward, and still the mono and stereo differences, you know, kept going. When we get to the White Album,
yes,
that's absolutely full of them. I mean, you know, prime examples, again, that come to mind for me are Don't Pass Me By, the Ringo track, which has got way more of the fiddle play all the way through, and it's faster as well.
Yeah, they sped it up like a half step.
Yeah, and then, you know, Helter Skelter is, I think, 50 seconds longer in the stereo version. Because you get that bit where it sort of comes back in and it ends with Ringo saying, I've got blisters on my fingers.
Yeah.
And that's not even on the mono mix, which is that's just like, astounding.
It's like the cherry on the top of that cake. It's like, I can't even imagine, you know, what it must have been like to hear the extended version for the first time if you were brought up on the mono short version.
But the fact that they were both available at roughly the same time.
Right.
So it's just like, what was going on there? What was, you know, the decision there? What did the Beatles even know that, you know, they'd slipped in this sort of longer version on the stereo? Was that when they had gone home? Or, I mean, it's just...
Maybe it was like, by all accounts that I've read, it was like, by that time, like sort of post-Pepper, they started getting a little bit more hands-on with the stereo stuff and paying more attention to it, recognizing that was the way things were going.
Yeah.
And, you know, it could have been they sort of intended as little Easter eggs or something for people to discover and figure out, oh, you know, the stereo and the mono, this is totally different. I mean, if you go to the White Album, you know, like you said, there's some songs that have the longer fades on them, like, you know, that whole coda on Helter Skelter, which is pretty substantial content-wise.
Yeah.
It's just not more jamming. It, like, fades up and down. You got the Ringo statement. Your blues had a longer fade out, but that's not anything dramatically different. When I think of, like, substantial differences, I look at Savoy Truffle, which is, in mono, a much rougher sounding mix. There's little noises that pop up.
Sound effects, aren't they?
Yeah, like little organ noises or something. We'll play that, and you can hear for yourself, you know, the differences. The stereo is so much more cleaner. Even the guitar solo is cleaner in stereo.
Yeah.
It's like they must have intended that to be the master.
Let's keeper. Not forget also the White Album sessions when they started using 8-track. The 8-track machine had come into the studio.
Yeah, and they had more to play with.
Yeah, George Harrison saw that in the corridor, and they... On his instructions, that was nabbed for the Beatles.
They liberated it.
Yeah, absolutely. They liberated it.
Stop.
Speaking of George and the White Album, this is something that, you know, I know there's probably enough hardcores listening to our show that know a lot of the Beatle lore without us having to tell it. But this was a question that popped up on my page the other day, and just for the sake of explaining it for everybody in case they might be wondering. I think people are under this misapprehension, if they know about it at all, that when George came to America, Los Angeles, in like October of 68, it was just in the weeks before the White Album was actually released, and he was at Capitol's offices, and he listened to their master of the White Album, and he was appalled at what he heard, how it was different than the tape that they had delivered, that they'd all signed off on in England, how Capitol, true to their mastering form, had put some compression on it, some limiting. They had distorted the sound of what the Beatles had intended to be the listening experience. And he personally supervised for 2 days at the facility they had there for mastering, restoring it back to the Beatles' intents before he allowed that record to come out in America. So there's
way to go, George.
Yes, all right, George. Some people think that he personally remixed the album. That's not what happened. It was a remastering issue.
Yes, it's time for the listener's question. And this week we've got Jeff from Downers Grove in Chicago.
I just wanted to get your guys' opinion. Do you prefer the English mono release of With the Beatles, or do you prefer the American stereo release of Meet the Beatles?
Interesting question. There's kind of two things going on there, actually, because there's like a big difference between the English and the American mixes, for one thing.
Yes.
You know, whether mono or stereo.
Right.
Because the American version is just smothered in reverb.
Right, and as it would be for the first several American releases.
Right, and that's the stuff that you guys were sort of raised on, but, you know, for us, it just sounds really weird, you know, for the Brits who've actually even heard the American versions.
Right. When did you start hearing that stuff? Probably much later, right?
Way 70s? Later. Yeah. You know, maybe in the 80s or something. You know, it was like a long time. It's like, what?
Right.
You know? And then it was introduced to me by a guy actually over here who's saying, you know, oh, I way prefer the American versions of all that, you know, echo. And it was like, oh my God, what have they done? Is that, was Phil Spector let loose on them or something?
It was, well, you know the story, right? It was Dave Dexter Jr., who worked for Capitol, who was a rock hater.
A rock hater,
absolutely. He was the one that was sort of the gateway keeping the Beatles from being signed to Capitol in the first place, because Alan Livingston, the head of Capitol, hadn't even heard them all the while, 1963, that they were being rejected by Capitol. And finally, it was Brian Epstein's intervention directly that got Alan to say yes. Got him to put it out in America at the end of 63. But anyway, so nonetheless, this guy who already was predisposed to not liking the Beatles anyway was the one who was allowed to prepare for American release.
Yeah, really? Exert his artistic sensibilities.
Yes, like, yeah. Fix them so that they were acceptable to American ears, which meant, you know, tons of echo and reverb and compression. And, you know, he's trying to fatten up the sound, basically, because he thought it was too thin and tinny sounding.
Well, so anyway, to answer Jeff's question, talking for me, I think I've already made it clear which version I prefer, which is, well, in this case, the mono English version of With the Beatles, but then again, even the stereo version that was released simultaneously. You know, I prefer that as well.
Well, you know, if you're talking about content now, if we can move away from the whole mixes discussion, I have to side with the English because, you know, there's a question of artistic integrity, what the Beatles were trying to do, you know, the sequencing and the way they saw their albums as sort of the separate entity from the single releases that they put out alongside.
And you also know I'm not let you get away with it anyway if you were trying to claim otherwise.
Well, so this would be the one time where we're in full agreement, despite your Englishness, of what the right answer is. So, yeah, you happen to be right.
In all seriousness, is there any count on which you prefer the American release or, you know, Meet the Beatles? Is there any aspect of that
well,
you prefer?
Okay, if we're talking about just that particular release, I have no objection to the sequencing. I think, you know, it was sort of artful the way, you know, yes, they dropped a number of cuts, you know, cover versions mostly, from the With the Beatles album, and they saved them for Beatles' second album. Both of those records, as listening experiences, I think hold together very well. It's almost like a different question, not what is artistically superior, because I would always have to side with the Parlophone releases. But, you know, can they be enjoyed as listening experiences? Sure they can.
Yeah, but that wasn't my question.
Well, what are you
saying? Answer my question.
Which is what?
My question was, Is there any aspect of Meet the Beatles that you prefer? Mm. Not that you can say it's a good listening experience, but do you actually prefer it in any respect?
You know, I kind of like it ending on Not a Second Time.
Really?
Yeah.
Because the whole thing with Money clearly is a kind of, you know, the same formula as the Please Please Me album.
Twist and Shout.
Which is twist, you know, end it with that raw rocker, Twist and Shout, Lennon, you know, shredding his vocal cords.
I get the calculation behind that, but, and maybe it's just my American ears and 40, 50 years of hearing it a certain way. I like Not a Second Time as a closer, leaving it sort of like the door open to more Beatles to come. And Money, for me, I like it on the Beatles' second album, the way it works. Now,
does anyone listening to this believe him? Or do you think
I think there's a lot of American people.
He had to find something.
Yes, I did. But but this is speaking as somebody that, on the whole, respects the English releases as artistic statements more, generally. And I would, you know, if we want to go further up the road, Rubber Soul in America was actually pretty artfully compiled. You know, it's a sort of retrospect where, you know, there are people that go around saying, oh, Capitol was trying to craft a folk rock album at the time. We don't know that. That was a hindsight observation, really. But it was very canny of them to open that collection with I've Just Seen a Face from the Help album to sort of set the tone. I mean, is it a folk rock album all the way through? No. I mean, where is If I Needed Someone? You know, the most Birds-like recording the Beatles ever issued on this ostensible folk album, it's not there in America. You know, that would have been the one to include if they were really being conscious of trying to craft a folk rock album for the American market. So I think it just lucked out, though, that they threw in a couple acoustic songs. You know, you've got your I've Just Seen a Face, you've got It's Only Love, both pulled from the Help album, that totally dovetail nicely with most of what was on Rubber Soul.
Okay, well, now I'm going to hit you with another question, Robert. What? Do you prefer the German version or the English version of Come Give Me a Dein Hand, I Want to Hold Your Hand, or Sie Liebt Dich?
Oh, jeez.
I don't know if my pronunciation's very good, folks, but
yeah,
sure Sie Liebt Dich for She Loves You, which was an all-new recording, by the way.
I thought it was so cheap and tacky to stick that on something new in 1964 just to fill up album space. I mean, what the hell did anybody in America need a German language version of I Want to Hold Your Hand?
Most say the people in, you know, Wisconsin and
Pennsylvania. Right. To me it was just album filler. You know, they didn't need to do that. But, you know, for a listening experience, you know, it's interesting to me in as much as, you know, we now know that they had the multi-tracks available for I Want to Hold Your Hand by the time they were shoved into the studio to do the German language version of I Want to Hold Your Hand. So they were able to cut a new vocal and put it on there. But the multi-tracks of She Loves You didn't exist at that time. And so you've got Sie Liebt Dich is an entirely brand new recording of She Loves You done in early 64. So to me, the most interesting point about those German language recordings is just that there's a fresh take on She Loves You recorded, you know, half a year after the original was recorded.
Yeah. Now, on that subject, we're talking about, you know, I Want to Hold Your Hand.
Yes.
There's a new ebook out by Alan Kozin of the New York Times called Got That Something, which is one of the notable lines from I Want to Hold Your Hand. Full title of the ebook is Got That Something? How the Beatles' I Want to Hold Your Hand Changed Everything. It's available on the Kindle. It's an iBook. And it's actually a fantastic read. I read it. It's a pretty swift read. And the musicology aspects of that book are just wonderful. So anyway, I spoke with Alan recently, not only about the main song that's featured in the title of his book, but also some of the other tracks that he discusses in there. We know that the Beatles obviously brought American rock and roll back to these shores in their own style. But really, when I listen to songs like She Loves You, I Want to Hold Your Hand, From Me to You, Please Please Me, none of them really sound like anything American particularly, do they? They're really a very unique sound.
I don't think there was anything that sounded like it, certainly not among American rock, and also not among the things that they were particularly influenced by, which would be R&B. You know, you just didn't hear the kind of sound that they had, but part of it has to do with, you know, if you listen to the BBC recordings, you sort of hear a bit of what their sources are, because they're playing cover versions of those American songs. And yet they're harmonizing a lot of them in the way the Beatles did. You know, that was their personal stamp. And I think what they did is they synthesized these elements that they sort of picked up from American records and things that they heard growing up in English music, in music hall stuff, and in folk stuff, and in, you know, whatever else was in the air. And they sort of synthesized it into something that wasn't any of those elements, but was theirs. And that was the trick, you know. I mean, once you could get the stuff heard, which apparently Swan and VJ couldn't, but Capitol had the clout to do, once people heard it, they had to recognize that there is something fresh and new and original here.
You know, before, when I was referring to how different those early recordings sounded compared to anything else that anyone had ever recorded, in terms of She Loves You, do you think the main unique aspect of that recording was down to the musical structure?
I think with She Loves You, it wouldn't have been the structure so much as the content, the lyrical content in a way. Well, the aspects of the structure too. I mean, the structure, I mean, keep in mind, it's the only one of those early songs without a bridge at all, which is kind of strange, but it gives you one less element to work with. But you do have, as I point out, that that business of that little three-note descending figure that you hear both in the refrain and in various iterations of Harrison's guitar part that goes all through it. I mean, I think I counted 15 examples of it in the brief period of the song, you know, one way or another. You're hearing it either sung or played. So there are elements like that, but you know, the interesting thing about She Loves You for me is that it's sort of a third person little drama, which is something they hadn't tried before. And they didn't really do much of that again until later in their career. And it was more like, you know, Rocky Raccoon or something, you know, it was just little stories taking place. So that's the interesting thing about that for me. Plus, you know, there was something for the time. The whole yeah, yeah, yeah business was, I mean, that caught everybody's imagination here anyway. I don't know how it was in England.
Yeah, it was the big catchphrase there too, just a few months earlier than in America.
Yeah. So, you know, there was, it just had that motto that was inescapable. I mean, I'm not sure, I guess because Swan Records was such a small company, it didn't really have the clout to cut through over here, but it's sort of hard to imagine how that record came out and didn't become a hit.
I Want to Hold Your Hand was the first recording by the Beatles done on the four-track machine. I know that that had been used for classical recordings at the EMI studios, but not for any of the rock recordings, as far as I know. How did that change their approach, the Beatles' approach, to recording?
Well, for this recording, you know, it was completely new to them, so they were using it partly in the same way that they used two-track, and that I'm pretty sure the performance was done all at once, or the main part of the performance. You know, they sang and played just as they had done for two-track. And in two-track, as you know, EMI's equipment couldn't record the two tracks separately. You had to record them both at once. And so to get a basic take, you had to sing and play at once. And I think that's what they were used to doing at this point. So they did that. But instead of all the instruments going on one track and all the vocals on a second track, and then copying the tape to overdub, what they were able to do was split the basic performance three ways. So you had the rhythm track on track one. And so that's John's guitar, Ringo's drums, and Paul's bass. And then on track two, you've got just George's lead guitar part all on its own. Track three, you've got the vocals, both lead and harmony, together. And then track four, you have the ability to add all kinds of nice little touches, which for them were, first of all, the clapping, which back in the days of I Saw Her Standing There would have meant actually copying the two-track to a second two-track and adding the clapping along the way. So you lose generation of tape, you get a little bit of tape hiss and a little bit of degradation. I mean, not that much because they're using pretty, you know, good equipment, you know. But still, I mean, producers and engineers would prefer not to lose as anything at all. With the fourth track, you were able to add those hand claps without losing anything. They also, and this was sort of interesting to me, at the end of each verse and in the refrain, when they sing, "I want to hold your hand and leap up an octave to a falsetto on hand," they doubled that. So you hear on this overdub track the clapping, and then whenever they get to hand, you hear hand all on its own. You know, they just needed to double that one note. And so that made me go back to the vocal track to hear whether, well, did they need to double it because it was weak or what? And on the vocal track, it's not weak at all. You know, they just obviously felt that that falsetto was so important that they wanted to make sure it was doubled and firm and strong. Then on the second bridge, John sings his whole vocal again, double tracks the vocal. So then you wonder, why just the second bridge? And it seems pretty clear that what they wanted to do was build some kind of tension, you know, and so the second bridge, because the vocals double track, sounds a little bit different than the first bridge did and a little bit stronger. And the other thing on there that caught my ear was that five note turnaround, you know, do, 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 do in between lines. It's not on the rhythm track. It's not in George's lead track. There's some question about what it is, actually. I mean, I hear it as a bass. Other people argue that it is a guitar, and there are reasons for each point of view. I mean, when they played it live, it was part of George's guitar part, but it was not part of the lead guitar part on track two. It sounds to me like it's played at the top of the bass, so it's in the guitar's range, but it has that kind of bass heft, you know? And also there was an edition of Beatles Monthly in 1963 that just in passing wrote, "The unusual bass part on I Want to Hold Your Hand was a collaboration between George and Paul." And what are they talking about if that overdub isn't a bass and if George isn't playing it instead of Paul? So there's still some mysteries there, but anyway, you know, when you listen to the four tracks separately, it tells you a lot about how they made it.
I Want to Hold Your Hand fed into that whole image of the Beatles as the lovable mop tops, which is what, you know, Andrew Lou Oldham pitched the Stones against, didn't he? But as you mentioned in the book, I Want to Hold Your Hand wasn't really quite as innocent as people may have, you know, perceived it at the time.
Yeah, I don't think it is. You know, the Stones and their publicists took advantage of I Want to Hold Your Hand, or simply the title of it. And in a way, it was kind of cynical, seeing as their manager publicist at the time actually had worked for Brian Epstein. And started this business of, you know, the Stones are the bad boys and the Beatles, you know, just want to hold your hand. And you know, and it found finally its, you know, grandest expression in Tom Wolfe saying the Beatles want to hold your hand, but the Stones want to burn down your town, which is kind of silly. But yeah, the subtext of the song, I mean, if you listen to it, not so much in the lyrics, but in the combination of the lyrics and the melody, you get to that refrain and it's, you know, I want to hold your hand up to that octave leap. I mean, that octave leap is quite often in music a sort of symbol of a kind of sexual tension, and particularly leaping to a falsetto. I mean, it's just sort of, it's almost subliminal, you know. It's there's something going on here. There's a desperation and urgency that has to go beyond hand-holding. You know, and the same with the bridge, that repetition three times, I can't hide, I can't hide, I can't hide. There's just a lot more going on than you would expect in a song just about wanting to hold your hand, which is very decorous, you know. And that's apart from, I mean, I didn't get into this in the book, but as you know, John used to refer to it sometimes as I want to hold your head. You know, and you can hear him, I'm pretty sure, singing that live on some live recordings. So, you know, I think there was a bit more there than meets the ear immediately, but the music is really telling that story in a way that the lyrics aren't. Also, you know, the third verse, which I got the title of the book from, you got that something. You know, that's one of those sort of bluesy suggestion lines. And when I talk to Billy Gibbons from ZZ Top, or in those days, Moving Sidewalks, who recorded I Want to Hold Your Hand, I mean, I mentioned to him that on their version, they never actually sing the first verse, oh, I'll tell you something, I think you'll understand. They go immediately to, you got that something, I think you'll understand. And when they sing that verse twice. And my feeling was, and I figured I'd run it past him since he was on the phone, was that here they are recording this song in 1968 when it was a totally uncool song to record. I mean, in 64 it was one thing. In 68, everybody's getting psychedelic and druggy and, you know, sexualized and everything. You just could not record that song straightforwardly. And my feeling was, especially the way they sing it with a kind of leer, that when they're saying you got that something, they're hearing it as, you know, sexual suggestion. And he said, yeah, you've got it. That's exactly what the code was. And we were a blues band, and blues sometimes speaks through indirection and imprecision. You don't have to say it right out. And that's what we heard, and you got that something.
So just in your opinion, do you think that the lyrical suggestiveness was intentional on their part, or something that other people are reading things into?
I have a feeling that a line like you've got that something did mean to them, you know, more than meets the ear. I mean, in the same way that, you know, she was just 17, you know what I mean, you know.
Such a feeling that my love, I can't hide, I can't hide.
that was a nice discussion of I Want to Hold Your Hand with Alan, and talking up a lot of what's in his new book. What we didn't talk about, though, is the flip side of the I Want to Hold Your Hand single as it was released in England.
This Boy.
This Boy, yes. One of these great examples pointed to when they talk about the Beatles as singers, especially John Lennon with that great soulful voice, you know, especially heard on the bridge, you know, that he sort of echoed a year or so later with Yes, It Is.
Yeah, I mean, fantastic three-part harmony that they actually did do together. And,
yes.
And reproduced it live, you know, did it on the Sullivan Show.
And, they did. Yeah. And it was beautiful, just the staging of it, the presentation where they put the three of them on the mic. Yeah. You know, they didn't need to do that, but they were, you know, going for the visual as much as the overall sound, you know, which is, you know, very crafty in thinking about their presentation.
Yes.
So that was the B-side in England. We got to hear it as the third track of Meet the Beatles when that came out in America in January of 64. They had switched I Saw Her Standing There, you know, from the Please Please Me album was the flip side of I Want to Hold Your Hand in America. You know, another canny choice. I can't argue really much with that. What we're going to hear now, before we close out the show, is some studio outtake of This Boy that was issued as a bonus track on the Free as a Bird single back in 95. This is them going through and tracking the song, running into a little trouble. You know, they frequently had pronoun trouble where John and Paul would sing opposite things.
About this and that. Yeah.
In this instance, yeah.
Well, they're actually singing them at the same time.
Yeah. And it's funny to listen to now, and thank God they preserved this stuff. But, you know, it is interesting, too, how a lot of those early recordings were spliced together from multiple takes. And how This Boy, even in finished form, you know, if your ears that are all attentive, you can hear coming out of that bridge where the splice is in that song, right, Richard?
Oh, God, yeah. I mean, before the Past Masters, on the original version, it's a very obvious cut. I mean, it's not particularly a click, but it just, the whole atmosphere, the audio atmosphere changes almost, you know, where John's put all that effort into his vocal on the bridge section, and then it just suddenly kind of clicks over to them all singing in a much sort of quieter tone.
Yeah, more subdued.
Yeah, and that's the word I was looking for, Robert. Thank you. Subdued, yes. Uh-huh. And and I noticed when it was, you know, issued on Past Masters that all of a sudden that had gone. They'd smoothed it out in the mix.
Yeah, that's something, you know, we can talk about that. You know, it's the Beatles, and like you said, George Martin was very conscious at times of them putting those little audio artifacts in there, you know, going for the feel, going for the excitement of the take, and if something was less than perfect, they would leave it in. And, you know, your ears get acclimated to this stuff through the decades of listening. You know, when they put out Beatles 1, I think that was the first instance where in Day Tripper, for instance, there's that little bit of dropout after the instrumental break that they fixed, and how that annoys me. Yeah, you know, it's like my ear is waiting to hear that. Yeah. I appreciate you fixing the sonic values of the thing, but, you know, we can stand a little imperfection when it comes to the Beatles.
Right, exactly. Yeah, don't mess with it too much.
Yeah, it's not necessary.
That's it for this show, and it's bye-bye from me, and it's bye-bye from
bloody little Mike
Robert.
Out of the way.
Bye.
Don't be nervous, John.
I'm not.
Don't be nervous.
Boy took my love away, but he'll regret it someday. This boy wants you back again. That boy. That boy!
I just went dead loud.
Oh, come on.
Don't have stirrups anymore.
That boy. Someday, but this boy wants you back again. That boy. isn't good for you. Though he may want you to, this boy wants you back again.
Something About the Beatles, produced by Thomas Rapetney at Strad Studio, executive producer Rick Wade.